of a 5-day session on finding faith in the wilderness, adventures in the book of Exodus. And today we're going to look at scarcity or blessing in the wilderness. And specifically looking at Exodus 15 and 16. And why don't we begin with a prayer and then have someone read the text. Let's pray. God, I thank you that we can gather in your name. I thank you for your scriptures. They're a wilderness for us oftentimes, and we don't know where we're going. I don't know where I'm going. So, Lord, have mercy and guide us as we wander through this story. Illuminate our minds. Send your Holy Spirit to open our hearts, open our minds, so we can hear a word that we need to hear. I just pray this in the name of Jesus. Now our first two sessions, we talked a bit about, or we talked in some depth about Egypt and the whole process of liberation. And I want to remind you of this schema. We'll go through it a little bit in a few minutes. I think the story that we're going to read today is all about the spiritual process of switching allegiances from Pharaoh to the Lord. You know, from the system of domination, which in the case of the book of Exodus is Egypt, represented by Egypt, and the new life in the desert, which is following God, you know, following the Lord. Well, why don't we read this text, Exodus 15, 22 through 16, 7. Exodus 15, 22 through 16, 7. And think about this question. Think about what you think is the heart of the matter of this text. What's really happening in this story? Maybe I'll just read it so I'm sure everyone can hear. Exodus 15:22. Then Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. This is why it was called Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" He cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and ordinance. And there he put them to the test. He said, "If you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give heed to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water. The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us? So, let's see, I'll put the text up here for anyone that comes in later. Okay, so one of the things to remember here, we just talked about that in the text that immediately precedes this, we have Israelites 400 years in Egypt, right? Where their most recent experience was being slaves, you know, serving Pharaoh, okay? Under this system of domination represented by Egypt, okay? And we just had, immediately preceding this story, we've seen that the Israelites fleeing and getting caught, you know, right against the sea and the wilderness and not being able to go anywhere. And being in this place where actually God sort of baited the Egyptians to come after them so that there could be a confrontation where the Lord could show that the Lord is Savior and can save them from all these forces that are pursuing them, that are aggressively pursuing them. Okay, and the key text here is when Moses tells the people, when they're all anxious, they say, we want to go back to Egypt. You know, why did you bring us out here? And Moses says, look, be still, right? And the Lord will fight for you. You've only to wait and to watch the salvation of God. And then this is an impossible sort of situation, right? The sea is right before them, and so even in the face of what seemed like absolute impossibility, Moses is told by the Lord to lift up his staff, and he makes a way opens up, and all the Israelites go through, and the Egyptians go through, and then God just wipes out all the Egyptians, and the Israelites are left in the wilderness, free from the system of domination. Now, one of the things that the text stresses is, I mean, how many days does it say that the Israelites journey at this point? To kind of begin our story.
What's that? 3.5 months.
Verse
22.
3 days.
Okay, let's look at that carefully.
3 days. 3 days.
And they went into the wilderness for sure. They went 3 days in the wilderness. Okay. Now I don't know if you remember this, but all through the book of Exodus, Moses is telling Pharaoh, "Let my people go. Let them take a 3-day trip into the wilderness so that they can serve, so that they can worship the Lord." Okay, this has been the main demand that Pharaoh has been receiving from Moses. Okay, so now they're actually realizing this command. They've taken a 3-day journey to worship the Lord. Okay, and what do they experience at the end of this 3-day journey? Well, first of all, what do you think would be the expectation of what they would experience after the 3 days into the wilderness? Here, that this has been what they've been told all the time, a three-day journey into the wilderness to worship the Lord.
To connect with God.
What's that?
They expected to connect with God.
They expected to connect with God, okay.
Instead, they're hungry and thirsty.
Yes, exactly. So what they experience after they've been saved, so to speak, is what?
Disappointment.
Disappointment, okay. More concretely, what they've experienced is thirst, right? They're thirsty. There's no water. There's water, but it's bitter.
Okay?
There's not a satisfaction, okay? And I really think that Exodus here is saying something. The writer of Exodus is saying something about the human situation, the human condition, that I think is very true. You know, there's this expectation, and it's often promoted by our churches, that, you know, once you're saved, life is going to be easy. Life's going to be better. You know, in the jails, it's a common thing for fundamentalist groups and lots of different groups to say, look, accept Jesus, you know, make a decision. After that, your addictions are going to go away. I mean, you know, look at what happened to me. I used to be a heroin addict. I was this and I was that. And I was miraculously delivered from all of my addictions. You know, you hear that from more Pentecostal groups. And from other groups, you just hear, make a decision, you know, accept Jesus. And the assumption is that everything's going to be okay. or join our church. And the assumption is if you join our church and you participate in worship and the sacraments and everything, the assumption is that life is going to get better, isn't it?
Would you say? Take care of you.
What's that?
We'll take care of you.
We'll take care of you? Okay.
Jesus will take care of you. We're not very good at taking ownership of helping others.
Yeah, right. Okay. So Jesus will take care of you. But the assumption is that life is going to get better. Okay, well, that's a normal assumption. That's a normal reason to get religious. I don't know how many of you were here last night for the drama of Martin Luther and Martin and Katie Luther. But, Martin Luther was talking about how the whole religious system that he was in was, he was afraid of the big stick. Okay, so get religious so that you can avoid punishment. But then that changed to be get religious so that you will have a reward. Okay. If you, a lot of people move out of an image of God as a punishing God who you have to flee from, like a police kind of chief or probation officer God that if you don't behave, you know, you're going to get more time or more punishment. Okay, people might move away from that to another image of God, but that image of God might be equally difficult, which is follow God and you will experience immediate reward. Okay, those are the two major motivations that religious groups use to bring in the masses. And some of the groups that are the most rapidly growing groups are groups that use those two techniques, fear of punishment, promise of reward. Okay.
Could I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long time since the children of Israel really have experienced worship. They as a community, mm-hmm. they've been under dominance for 400 years.
Yes.
So the whole concept of experiencing worship in that 3 days seems to have a meaning that God is wanting to say to them, something really is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because God acts. 3 days is a number of God acting.
In the New Testament it is.
And so here the children of Israel are really not prepared for that. They're still stuck in kind of, well, at least we were taken care of. We weren't happy, but we were taken care of.
Okay, yeah. So they don't know what worship is, but do we know what worship is?
Yeah, I was going to ask if they had, was worship really a part of the practice before Joseph and his family moved into Egypt? Was it even part of their historical memory?
There's no mention of it.
Yeah, or is it something that they picked up from Egyptian culture?
We don't know because there's absolutely no mention of it in the book previous to this in Exodus. Okay, there's mention of it in the before they get to Egypt. The patriarchs are building altars and they're calling on the name of the Lord, but there's no idea. There's no mention of any kind of collective worship. Okay, so but one thing is the word that is used for worship is serve. You know, you will go out and serve the Lord. Okay. In contrast to serving Pharaoh. Okay, so there's the contrast that's going on in Exodus is who do you serve? Do you serve God or do you serve the system of domination? Do you serve Pharaoh? Okay, that's the contrast. So what does service mean? You know, does it mean? That's a big question that maybe we'll find some clarity on as we move through this. I believe that what's happening is okay. We have this experience of emptiness, of thirst. And what I think is happening here in the story of Exodus is Moses originally had to flee Egypt because of murdering an Egyptian, right? And he was driving his flock into the wilderness. And we talked about this on Monday, how he went beyond the wilderness to this place called Horeb, which means scarcity, desolation. And it was when he got to this point of utter desolation that God met him. Okay, when he got to the dark place, beyond the wilderness, and we talked about how the wilderness was a place in Genesis. Every time the term wilderness, desert is used, it refers to this. It's a place where people either flee to or are driven to, where they experience where they kind of bottom out. I mean, it's like the first step, you know, coming to the point of total emptiness and desolation. That's really how wilderness functions, in the way it's used in the different stories, okay? So anyway, but Moses drives his flock beyond the wilderness, and it's there that the Lord appears to him. Okay, well here, I think what we have happening is God is taking Moses and all of the people. See, driving the flock is metaphoric for driving the people. And now Moses is going to drive the people beyond the wilderness, possibly to a similar place of revelation. And they're having to flee for the same reasons, because of the death of the firstborn Egyptians, right? So in a way, God is taking the people on the very same journey that Moses has already gone. You know, they're viewed almost as outlaws, as people who are offenders, right? Who now, as a collective body, are heading to a place where are they going to find faith? Are they going to find a faith that works in places of scarcity, in places of emptiness? This is the question. One of the big difficulties that I think that we have in the book of Exodus and in faith, in the Christian faith in general, is why does there have to be this whole process between Egypt and the Promised Land? Why doesn't salvation consist of simply moving from here right to here?
Because you need no faith.
Well, who cares? Why do we have to go through this struggle? Why can't we just be saved? Why can't we just go to heaven right now? You know, why can't we just live in the reign of God in the fullness right now? You know, what is this? Why all of this struggle? Why the wilderness? Why is this, you know, in between, you know, bondage and promised land? You know, I think you're onto something, you know, in terms of finding faith.
I believe that we'll go through because it's really what Jesus went through too. He went through a lot to get so I can get hope and faith that it's gonna be some good. When I get through going through my trials and tribulations, that I'm gonna reach the promised land because that's what Jesus did. After being crucified and all that, coming down, doing good things, being crucified, being resurrected from the dead.
Okay.
I think so, also without the wilderness, we don't have to depend on God. We would never have to depend on God. We would always think we could do it ourselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is all about. I mean, it's stated very clearly in chapter 15, verse 24, I think it is. Further on, 25. There the Lord made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he put them to the test. He said, if you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give heed to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that are brought upon the Egyptians, for I'm the Lord who heals you. Okay. So this is all about learning to hear the voice. Okay. God wants the people to experience a relationship where they're discerning, they're hearing the voice, they're learning how they're learning how to switch allegiances from the Pharaoh and all the voices that they know. They know the voices of the taskmasters. Do this. Bring this many bricks. Don't do this. If you don't, and they know about the threat. Okay. Well, now it's time to learn to hear the voice of the Spirit, which is one that takes an incredible amount of mentoring and. It's a whole training process in discernment. How do you hear the voice? How do you know it's God who's speaking? And this is very much the same word, or a similar word that you have in chapter 16. Verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way, I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. I don't like that translation. It's more whether they will walk in my Torah. That's the actual wording. Whether they will walk in my teaching. Okay, so walking in the teaching and learning to hear the voice of God, that is a process of discipleship, of learning. Okay. And
The one problem I have with that, Rob, is that it does reinforce at the same time. I hear what you're saying in terms of if you do this, then you'll be spared. It does. There also is that element in there of God as the great policeman, too. And, you know, when you're parsing out the Old Testament, you always bump up against that kind of image of God. What do you do when you it bangs you in the face. You just kind of ignore that part of it, or what?
No, I think that was the law. Now we have the gospel.
I mean,
I don't know that it was any different back then. I don't agree with that. I don't see a distinction between the Hebrew text, Hebrew scriptures, and the New Testament. I think there's way more continuity than there is discontinuity. But anyway, let's move through here and see if we get any more clarity.
Sure.
Okay, we have a ways to go in this study. Someone shut that door.
Yeah.
Okay, so the people experience a lack. And what's interesting is, what is it that they desire? In chapter 16, we have this word that the people say to Moses. What do they say when they grumble? Verse 2 and 3. Can someone read verses 2 and 3?
In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve us, to starve this entire assembly to death."
Okay, so what is it that they are desiring?
Food.
Okay. What is it symbolically that they're desiring more than just food? What?
Freedom. Security.
Okay. They're experiencing emptiness, right? And now, out of that emptiness, what they desire is fullness. Okay, it's a desire to have their thirst quenched, which is a normal human desire. A question that I have is: in our systems that we live in, the systems of domination that we live in, what are some of the ways that we experience fullness, besides what might be called the right ways that we think are the right ways? What are the ways that people experience fullness?
Television.
Okay.
Measure of success.
Okay, so fullness through. We asked this question yesterday, but this is an important question to keep thinking about. Okay, television. Entertainment, right?
Money.
Money. Mm-hmm. How does money make you feel full and satisfied?
Possibilities,
okay?
Choices.
Buying stuff. Yeah, choices.
Choices.
Okay, money buys.
Choices.
Choices of material things, right?
And just buying, just purchasing.
Materialism.
Stuff.
Okay, buying. Buying is a process of experiencing fullness. And the more money we have, the more we're able to experience fullness and keep satisfying the lack, right? Filling the void. What are some other ways that we do this?
Relationships.
Money also buys experiences, like adventures and seeing exotic places.
Okay, experiences. What else? How else do we experience fullness?
Achievement.
Okay, so successes. Achievement. Jacques Lacan, a Freudian therapist in France, who I studied. I didn't study under him, but I studied under many of his disciples. He talks about how desire can only happen from out of a lack. True desire, which is the basis of faith, can only happen from out of a lack. So I lack. He turns the Descartes thing around, or not Descartes, I forget who it is, who says, "I think, therefore I am." It's Descartes.
Yes.
And he says, "I desire, therefore I exist, therefore I am. And if I have, I cease to be. You know, filling the void through possessing is a way for us to get out of that feeling of the existential anxiety of lacking. Okay, so objects of whatever they might be, and experiences. All of these things are ways to completely satiate ourselves.
A lot of times, we even give out of our excess instead of giving out of our first fruits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a feeling of fullness, too.
Right, definitely. Okay, so even giving?
Yeah, devoted to giving.
Giving or serving. You know, serving can often be a way to deal with our own guilt, okay, and to calm our anxiety, right, giving or serving. Okay, so how do we benefit? How do we actually benefit? What are the benefits of all this? And before I say that, there's a few other things that I want to mention. This isn't as much, well, this is many of the people that I serve, these are issues, but drugs and alcohol are big factors here, and other addictions, sexual addictions. Mm-hmm. The people that I serve as chaplain in Skagit County Jail are just caught up in these very pleasurable ways of dealing with anxiety. And pleasure, the pleasure that comes from the blast, you know, from heroin or cocaine or crack or whatever it might be, that is so seductive. Okay, so, but addictions are, I mean, there's just almost every possibility in terms of what you can be addicted to, right? Mm-hmm. But drugs,
cigarettes,
alcohol,
food,
gambling, exactly.
Rock and roll.
Sex. What did you say? Rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
No, rock and roll.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Sugar.
Cigarettes
are a drug.
Painkillers.
You know, these painkillers are one of the major drugs of choice. It's the drug of choice on the streets. Mm-hmm. You know, in our area, oftentimes, in the past, it's been Xanax. And I mean, many of these painkillers, I mean, the prescription drug abuse is one of the most rampant forms of drug abuse in our country. And so a desire to escape pain through whatever means is what the American culture is all about, right? In part.
Where would you put something like celebration in that?
Well, okay, that's a good question. Celebration can also be, and worship, collective worship, corporate worship, can also be a way to fill ourselves. And is it the Spirit? Is it the voice of the Spirit that is filling us when we get together in our corporate worship? Or is it something else? You know, in the Hebrew Scriptures, you have a continual word from the prophets where they differentiate between collective worship that is truly faithful worship and another worship.
Social.
Which is not true worship, okay? So knowing what true worship is, and this is the whole question of, you know, the going 3 days into the wilderness to serve the Lord. The fact that 3 days brings the people to this place of emptiness brings up lots of questions about what true service is all about. What is the service? What is worship?
The other thing I keep hearing, though, is the children of Israel are being brought out to serve God. Why in the heck would they do that? Because what has dominated them, though it has persecuted them, though it has beaten them, it has always told them, I'm taking care of you. And that which dominates us always has that subtleness of saying, I have a right to do this to you because I'm taking care of you. And
the problem is
children of abuse. Getting out of that abuse is difficult because that's what they experience.
The problem is there's a downside to this fullness, okay?
Right.
That everyone can talk about when they get real, okay? Mm-hmm. The men that I talk with in the jail are people that they've lived all the fantasies that I've ever had in my life, plus a million more, right? I mean, they're just, they've had every experience. They've done everything, right? And when we get down and we have... Now, our Bible studies are more like therapy sessions. I mean, we're really talking about our lives. People are talking about their lives in the text, lives, text, back and forth, kind of like what we're doing a bit here. But often it goes further and deeper, you know, because it's smaller groups and there's more closeness and trust. Okay, but what's important is to be able to know, okay, well, what... I ask the question, how do we experience fullness and how do we benefit from our fullness? The other question would be, what are the disadvantages? What's the downside to our fullness?
Self-reliance?
No, I'm saying what are some of the disadvantages or some of the ways that we suffer as a result of our ways of experiencing fullness?
Well, self-reliance leads to disconnect from God, so I see that as a downside.
Okay. So, self-reliance?
Guilt.
Leads to isolation?
Depression.
False sense of...
Depression, false sense of control,
low self-esteem.
Where does that come from?
What?
How does that tie in? How do you what might be some ways that we experience a low self-esteem as a result of this?
Because if I'm using drugs, if I'm gambling or doing sex to make me feel good and it's really not, then I'm doing something to hurt me, and that's because I got low self-esteem.
Right. Okay. So, and it leads to even further low self-esteem.
Further, the lower, yeah. the more I judge, the lower the self-esteem becomes.
Well, it appears to me that it's unending. If you continue in it.
What's that?
It's unending. It just, you continue on and on and on, and if you have money, you want more money
more money.
Yeah. Okay.
The sense of fullness is very short-lived, and you have to keep feeding it, keep topping it off, and you always know it's never going to be enough.
Right.
Okay. So never satisfied.
Temporary.
I grew up in a suburb of Seattle, a wealthy suburb of Seattle, where there were so many wealthy people who committed suicide. It was just incredible. I mean, our high school, there were many suicides, and it was because the kids, usually it was very wealthy kids that had had everything, but they were unhappy. They still had this emptiness, this void. So, the poverty of affluence is something many of us haven't bottomed out in terms of affluence, right? Like a lot of extremely wealthy people have. Okay, but wealthy people are often some of the most isolated, lonely people out there. Mm-hmm. Okay, because they've been there and they've done that, and yet there's still this void.
Can you put down discontentment?
Discontentment.
The pursuit of fullness in any manner is very egocentric, and so it doesn't allow for relationships.
Yeah, okay, so it's self-reliance leads to isolation, lack of relationship. You know, because...
Aren't we born to be this way?
What's that?
Aren't we born to be this way?
Are we wired to be
natural.
This way? Yeah, that's a good question.
It is a natural desire to survive and serve yourself.
Yeah, okay.
The other way is not natural at all. It's not the way we were born.
But I wonder if we're getting into a gender issue here, because it seems like men are so often wired towards self-reliance, mm-hmm. and women are so often wired towards connecting and community.
Okay, so when women become, and there's a downside to the wire being wired to connect and community, sometimes for women, right? Which what might that be?
If you can't connect, or the dependence on being connected to feel happy or feel.
Okay, so not being able to connect, the feeling of seeking, desiring connection, but not experiencing connection. Okay, so discontentment through not connecting. What would be another downside to the women's desire for relationship and finding it that way rather than self-reliance?
Can't say no when you do
many
things.
Boundary issues.
Okay.
People please.
Okay. Right. So can't say no. Say yes, 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 and then find once again self.
You're unhappy. At the end of the day, you're unhappy because you're giving it all away and you don't know what you've gotten.
I feel that that's kind of sexist, because I feel that a lot of men do the same thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of men try to please other people.
People please.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of men that are that way. There's a lot of men in the healthcare industry that are the same as women. So I think that's a sexist issue.
Okay. So, and if you are a people pleaser, does that work?
Nope. No. For just for the moment.
Yeah.
It had worked for me for a moment. Mm-hmm. Then when that satisfaction comes, you know, like, oh, I satisfied somebody, then I look around, oh, I forget about me, and then I get sad, or you know.
So it's often done at the expense of self. And then self-esteem goes down as well, because self hasn't been taken care of. Okay.
But where do you draw these lines? Because right now, as far as me listening to what's going on, we're headed towards selfishness. That I've got to take care of me first, kind of thing. And if there's anything left over, then I may give it to you.
No, and I think that's a very good question, and we're going there. Okay, we need to look at what the response of the writer of Exodus is to this whole dilemma. Okay, because I mean, this is the dilemma we're in, wouldn't you say? In our world, we see it all around us.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the spiritual? What is the an authentic spirituality that allows us to respond to? To find satisfaction, to find faith in the wilderness. Let's look at the next little word a little bit more in depth. Maybe it isn't the next one, but verse 3, the Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. What do you think is going on here? What are the Israelites saying? They grumbled against the Lord because they expected life under the Lord to be a better alternative to life under Pharaoh, right? But when they challenge, when the Israelites challenge Moses, is it a challenge that life under Pharaoh was actually better than life under the Lord? Is there any evidence that life under Pharaoh was better? There's no evidence in the story that the Israelites sat around pots of meat and ate bread until they were filled. Okay, where does that come from? Is that just selective remembering? Is it the sort of selective remembering that often happens in the jail, in the female pod? The women always talk about how everyone is talking about doing drugs. A lot of women are just talking about it and fantasizing about stuff that they were doing on the outs, right? And just ready. Not everyone, because there's people that have bottomed out and that are tired and they don't want that. But there's, and in the men's pod, it happens a little less because the men aren't as vulnerable with each other and talking about all that. But that's why I mentioned the female pod of our jail. It's like the women, there's all this going on, this remembering with nostalgia, about the life out there. Even though it's gotten them there and it's led to all kinds of incredible suffering, right?
I think it's a comfort zone. Comfort zone. That's what they're used to and comfortable with.
Okay. Right. And so to take another path that they've never been on, that's very frightening. It's terrifying.
It is.
There also just seems to be a lot of false expectations. Like with the pots of meat. What did they expect when they went out into the wilderness to be with God? Was life going to get just honky-dory? So I think there were just these amazing false expectations. But I think we have those false expectations sometimes too.
I think you're right, absolutely. And so and we're going to go further in that direction, okay? I have a theory about this sitting by the pots of flesh and eating bread that I haven't seen anywhere else, and it's kind of a wild idea, but I think it works. I'm becoming more confident in it. Could this refer to the Passover? When Israel ate meat and bread, I believe this is referring to the night of the Passover. When here they just slaughtered the lamb, and they were eating the bread, eating the meat, and it was on that very night that the Israelites. It was that Passover meal that led to. This period of incredible difficulty.
It was the last straw.
Eating the meal was what broke, the oppression of Egypt. It broke the oppressor, but only for an instant in a way, right? Because the people are off and running, and then Pharaoh's heart is hardened, and he's immediately after them. In the same way, the Lord's Supper, Jesus celebrated with his disciples, and even in the middle of the supper, Judas is off to betray him, and then Peter's being confronted that he'll deny him, and all the people scatter. And in between the supper, or after the supper, comes the cross. Okay, it's not simultaneous. Okay, so great suffering is in store for them. But for the Egyptians, the moment of the Passover was a liberation from this life. Okay, they were beamed up. Okay. The firstborn of the Egyptians were beamed up, Could this be like a desire to die in fullness? And this is a psychological idea, that Freud and Lacan have as well, that they say that all of us, what we really desire is to go back to the womb. We desire to have so that we can cease to desire, because to desire there's pain, there's suffering involved in desire. So could this be a death wish, in a way? To die at the moment of fullness. And this is something that I see in our world out there in terms of worshiping communities. There are worshiping communities that bring people up to a place of ecstatic worship, right? And that worship is something that is people desire to be, to repeat over and over and over and over, to almost live in this ecstasy, right, of worship. You know, and then could this be reflecting a desire that maybe all of us or many of us have, to just get beamed up rather than to have to find faith, and you know, which is precarious. I think of an example of this is I was dealing with a man who had a conversion in one of my jail Bible studies and was there for 6 months and really came a long ways, but got out. This guy was the car mechanic for all the drug dealers in our county. So when he got out, his only way of making money was to keep fixing their cars. And he kind of was the mechanic for the underclass. And his way of payment was he'd do a car and people wouldn't have money sometimes and they'd give him drugs or alcohol. They'd bring him a half a case of Budweiser or whatever. He'd, you know, or drugs. And anyway, so it was hard for him to just get out of that immediately, because he had this whole network of people who would come to his house day and night with their cars. Okay, so he was at a house one night, and he just finished fixing some drug dealer's car, and the guy invited him in for a beer, and he came in, and they were sitting in a couch. And my friend said, "Do you believe in God?" And the drug dealer said, "Oh, forget it, man. I mean, God doesn't exist. There's no way, you know." And he says, "Well, what about just your death? What do you think? I mean, you know, what do you think about your death? How do you feel about your death? And it could happen at any time. I mean, doesn't that give you anxiety? Does that cause you to seek after God?" And the guy says, "No way. You know, God is nowhere. There's no God." He says, "I want to die with my pockets full of cash and a good blast, you know, a good buzz from some crack or whatever. I want to die like that." Right when he said it, a guy burst into their apartment with a sawed-off shotgun, aimed it right at the man and killed him, blew him away. And my friend came to me just trembling that night. He just says, "Roberto, I just got to talk to you, man. What I just saw is so crazy." You know, and I'm wondering whether in a way that is exactly what in a way is the desire, that desire of that drug dealer was fulfilled in a way, in the same way that, I mean, this is the desire of these people. It's like, why couldn't we have died at the Lord's hand when our bellies were full, you know? Instead, we have to go out and die. You have to kill us in this wilderness.
That was his God.
What's that?
The lifestyle was his God.
The lifestyle was his God.
The lifestyle was his God.
But it's a seductive God.
Seductive, right?
You know, it is so seductive.
Never satisfying God.
Never satisfying.
Yeah. My grandmother died. She's a faithful Catholic woman. Went to the flea market on Saturday, sold her hand crocheted doilies, and went home, laid in bed, was saying her rosary, fell asleep, and died in her sleep with a rosary in her hand and a smile on her face. And I'll tell you, that's how I want to die.
Wow.
Just to paint a different image, folks. Yeah. She was in her 80s.
Good arm.
Stout little Catholic woman.
So anyway, I think we want fullness. We don't want this place of insecurity. And death at the moment of fullness appears to be a better alternative than this contrast between fullness and emptiness. Okay? And in many ways, this is why Christianity, where true faith is a hard sell. And true faith is something that can only be found in the wilderness, in a place where lack is, where people are up against their lacks, you know, where up against their emptiness over and over and over and over and over again. What's interesting about this story is that God doesn't respond like a punishing God. You know, God's first response is to the first grumbling, is it's like it's a nothing. Hey, take this piece of wood and throw it in the water. It's like this lack isn't that big of a thing. Don't take the lack so seriously. God can fill you. God can take care of your physical needs. And it can be that easy, you know, boom. Walk, you know, a piece of wood. It's just like it's like Jesus spitting on the ground and forming mud and just saying, "Hey, blindness, you know, go wash. It's all better." Or
why didn't you ask?
What's that?
Why didn't you ask in the first place?
Yeah, well, yeah. Or, you know, the way Jesus just sitting with a word will speak to a demon and it'll be gone from a person, right? We make such a big deal out of the scarcity, which comes out of our unbelief. Okay? But anyway, it's taken care of, and then the people, they come to this place called Elim. Does anyone know what Elim means? El is the term in Hebrew, gods, like Allah, El, it's the same thing. Elim means the gods. And what is there at the gods? There are 12 springs and 70 date palms. Okay. Now 70 is a symbolic term that means like absolute fullness and the totality of everything that you could need. Okay. So God provides abundance. God does fill to some extent. Okay. But so there's an incredible graciousness of God in terms of the way God deals with just our humanness and our frailness. You know, God's willing and able to bless us, even when we're experiencing this scarcity. Okay, the distance between the lack and the cry and the fullness, this appears to be very important. This is very, very important for God. It's like what there is a mini distance between Egypt and Promised Land happening on every stage of the way, over and over again, you know, in the wilderness. And it's that mini sort of period of going from lack, which inspires either unbelief or faith, and fullness, which inspires belief usually, that is what the spiritual life is all about, perhaps. Let's look at this from one other angle. Okay. Is liberation from slavery to a land flowing with milk and honey not enough? I mean, I guess we already looked at that. The answer over and over again in Exodus is no, it's not enough. It's not enough just to have the Elim, just to be an Elim, to be in the place of fullness. That's not enough. The Lord desires to enter into a relationship of trust. Okay, and it's that relationship with trust that is a place of is intimacy. Okay, there's an intimate relationship of trust, of learning to hear the voice and being in relationship that God desires. Okay, and that's what serving the Lord is, I think, is all about in Exodus. One of the dynamics that's happening in Exodus too is that it's easier to believe that God is bad, that God is perverse, that God is someone who you have to fear than it is to believe that God is good and loving. You know, it's extremely difficult to believe that God is good and loving when you're in the wilderness, when you're experiencing scarcity, because the question always comes up, why? You know, why scarcity? You know, why this period of suffering? Why this period of struggle? Why can't I just be beamed up or beamed over, you know? Why can't I just be easier? Why does it have to be so hard? Okay, so who are you, God? Are you the one who's after me? You know, are you the police that's just caught me one more time? Are you the probation officer that's violated me one more time? You know, are you the cancer, you know, the agent of cancer that has just come and ruined my life? Are you, you know, why did you let this happen? You know, that whole question is, you know, it's the same question that this is dealing with, I think. It's easier to believe that God is the author of all of that than it is to find faith and to experience God as good in the midst of it all. So anyway, what is the alternative? Let's look a little bit at the alternative that Exodus is promoting. How does God respond to the grumbling in this story? Well, before I answer that question, there's one more thing. This process in chapter 15, verse 24, 25, it says, 26. If you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and pay attention, give heed to his commandments and keep all of his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that are brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. Okay, the salvation process. Salvation, they're saved at this point, right? And someone pointed out yesterday, the day before, that that's what brought about faith. Okay, faith wasn't a prerequisite to salvation. Faith was the people believed once they were saved. Okay, but they weren't healed yet. A
So the wilderness is a place where the Lord heals. Okay, and that's part of what salvation is all about. Liberation is one thing. Salvation, being saved by God, is the first step, or one step in a whole process of healing, you know, which the Lord desires to do. But how does that healing take place? I think it has to do with learning to hear the voice. Okay, so verse 4 says, "The Lord said to Moses, I am going to rain bread from heaven for you. And each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. Or walk in my teaching or not." This idea of the manna, you know, being something that they have to collect every day, is directly tied to this idea of hearing the voice and learning to hear the voice. The voice of God and hearing the voice of God in the scriptures is the, in a way, the what is offered as the healing, what brings about the healing. And learning to live and depend upon the voice and feed off the voice is what it's all about. And we have a statement about that in Deuteronomy, which I'd like us to look at briefly. Deuteronomy 8, 2 to 5. Deuteronomy 8, 2 to 5. Could someone read that for us?
"Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothes did not wear out, and your feet did not swell during these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord your God disciplines you."
Okay, so the discipline is all about being in this place of being hungry in order that you might understand that one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Okay. And this notion of living off the word and feeding off the word and having your deepest lack, in a way, your deepest spiritual void sort of being filled by the word, and having that be something that is necessary every day, day by day by day by day by day. You know, the idea of the manna needing to be collected every day had two functions. One, it was about trust, learning how to trust that your actual physical needs were going to be taken care of. So you didn't need to hoard, because that you were getting it from the hand of God. And that whole story is the basis for Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, where it says, don't worry about what you eat or drink or put on, you know, but seek first his reign and his kingdom and his righteousness, and all of these things will be given to you, right?
Yeah.
So the idea of trust, total trust and dependency day by day by day, and not being able to hoard either materially or spiritually. You know, I mean, a lot of us, we go week to week or even less than that. We have our retreats, and then we have we have long periods of time where we just expect to be living off of this, of hoarding of spiritual knowledge or something. It's not like that. I mean, you know, AA people know very well that every day is a new day, right? Every day is a brand new, fresh start.
And then what you just got through reading in Matthew 6, 2, it also says that. Right after CD first, we talked about don't worry, don't take no thoughts for tomorrow. Today is the vision of the tomorrow.
Exactly. See, then that's directly Exodus, right? Every day. Okay.
It strikes me too that, you know, that in Egypt and in any domination system, the function is to really make people individuals, individualist, as we pointed out here, that you're in it by your own, on your own. There's no community that will take care of you. Mm-hmm. You know, I will take care of you. I will dominate, but I will take care of you. Mm-hmm. And so part of the learning here and this teaching that's going on is not only reliance on God, but on the spirit, you know, within the community.
Mm-hmm.
The hoarding mentality is one that you have if you're in it on your own. You know, yeah. If I don't believe there's going to be Social Security, well, you know, I'm going to get my own system. I'm going to look out for myself, maybe for my kids, but, you know, to hell with everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And because, you know, they're not going to care for me.
Yeah.
So part of this teaching, I think, is this, they've taken the slaves out of Egypt, but Egypt's still in the slave kind of thing, and they're trying to break that mentality of that you're only here by yourself. You know, that there's a community that has to function together to make this work.
Yet at the same time, there is an individual struggle that people are invited to participate in, because the community isn't always there for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, each family is to go out and to collect what they need for that day. Okay, so there is an individual. It's not just that we're going to find it in community either, because community can also be, you know, be a way that we fill the void. Right. We only have a couple minutes. Let me show you two more texts that give you this idea of the word as food. Deuteronomy does that. It wants to, it's in a way spiritualizes this, and we can't spiritualize it too much because there are physical needs that we need from, and God offers to provide for our physical needs. I mean, that's the text of Matthew, but that's Exodus 2. The manna is food that the people were given from God, from the hand of God in the desert, okay? But Deuteronomy says, no, the deeper meaning of it is the Lord's word coming from heaven is what you need to learn to live on. And this idea is present in Proverbs 9, 1-5. It says, wisdom has built her house. She has set up her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent her maids to call from the highest places in the town. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To the one who is without sense, she says, come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine that I have mixed. Okay, so here we have a word, and this is wisdom, okay, which is the Torah, the teaching, the word that provides food for the soul. And this is very much the Gospel of John works out of that very same tradition when Jesus says, look, I am the bread of life that came down from heaven. Your ancestors, they ate manna in the desert, but they died. Okay, so it's not enough just physical, having your physical needs met. We need spiritual, to be spiritually sustained. And when Jesus says, drink my body, eat my body, drink my blood, you know, he's inviting us. I mean, that's clearly an invitation to participate in the Eucharist and communion, that Lord's Supper, right, as something that sustains us. But at the same time, it's all about the word. Okay, so word, sacrament, and actual physical food are all part of the picture here. So Jesus says, it is I who is the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will not be hungry. Whoever comes to me will never thirst. Okay, and this is very much the teaching of Isaiah too, and I'll just close on this. Isaiah chapter 40, and chapter 50, verse 4. The Lord God has given me the tongue of a teacher, that I may know how to sustain the weary with a word. Morning by morning, he wakens my ear to listen as those who are taught, to listen as a disciple, is the actual literal translation, to listen as a disciple. Morning by morning, he wakens my ear to listen as those who are taught. Well, what is that wakening? You know, what does that feel like to be woken? So to listen. What do you think? How do you experience that? Do any of you experience that in any way? Being awakened to having your ear awakened, or being a readiness to hear?
could that be this experience of emptiness? Could that be something that is almost placed in us? As could this be part of what the discipline of the Lord is all about? Could it be part of just our, could our finitude be actually just a blessing, because it's out of that we cry for fullness? I mean, could that be a spiritual, what makes us spiritual beings? Is that how we experience our spirit, being spiritual beings, is that we lack, we desire? I believe it is. This is one of the ways God awakens us.
Part of the emptiness too is a very real fear. That when you're down in that pit and you feel empty and you feel like you either have nothing or you've lost everything, whichever way that strikes you, it's a real fear that you don't know if you can make it or not.
Yeah.
And that makes you real vulnerable.
Yeah.
And Bob, yeah. Matthew 5 and 6 also talked about he that hungers and thirsts after righteousness shall be
filled. Absolutely. Yeah, see, that's the same thing. Here's one more verse, okay? And then we can go and have some pastries or whatever we're going to have up there and get ourselves filled up. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you that have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourself in rich food. Incline your ear, and come to me. Listen, so that you may live. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.